You're listening to The Zesty Garden, and in studio with me today is Shane Taylor. He's the horticultural specialist and buyer for cactus and tropicals in Salt Lake City. And we're continuing our series of recommended houseplants. And today it's the ficus plant. I have to admit, this is not one I've ever grown. Although everybody seems to have one.
Yeah, everybody has one. You hear about people and their Ficus benjamina, which is the variety of ficus that everybody seems to have. One of my favorite ficuses is called the Ficus lyrata or the fiddly fig. And it's one type of ficus that has a much larger leaf than the other. And one of the biggest complaints of the benjaminas and some of the standard ficus is, I take it home and all it does is shed leaves. It sheds leaves all over the floor, all over the living room, and it's just a mess. And no matter what I do, I water it more, I water it less, it just drops leaves. Well, the Ficus lyrata, because the leaves are bigger, tends to hang on to its leaves. So it doesn't have that shedding problem as a lot of other ficus do. And of course, the shedding problem is just the way ficus grow. They're always growing new leaves, they're dropping old leaves, and people often react to it as if something is wrong with their plant, and they end up creating a problem.
They overwater it.
They overwater it. Think, oh no, it's dropping its leaves, I need to water more, whereas leaf drop is often just seasonal. It has to do with the level of light. It has to do with different factors throughout the year. But the lyrata, the fiddly fig, and that's another interesting thing, is fig and ficus, that's one and the same. So if you can say fig.
I was just going to say it looks like a fig plant.
Yep.
So that's what it is.
That's what it is. Okay. Yep. Fig are ficus botanically, and ficus are figs. And the fiddly fig is an ornamental. It doesn't grow edible figs on it, but it grows the big, beautiful, glossy green leaves that you would see on certain varieties of figs.
So this would be a good one if you're trying to fill a corner.
Yeah. It prefers anything from bright light all the way up to direct sun. The brighter the light, the thicker and fuller it will stay. It will grow in indirect light, but it will require maybe some staking to keep it strong, because generally in indirect light, they won't be as upright and strong on their own. But they're, as far as a ficus goes, I think it's just one of those that they're very popular right now. We bring a lot of them in because people like that look, that lush green look, with different styles that are, you'll see them in magazines nowadays. And they're just, they're fairly low maintenance compared to some of the other types of ficus as well. They require anywhere from every 5 days to every 14 days, depending on how big a pot size it is, for watering. If it's in a small pot and it's a big plant, it's going to be needed to be checked a little bit more often, maybe every 4 or 5 days.
The leaves look fairly thick. Do they wilt when they need water?
You know, they don't.
Okay.
This plant, the lyrata, won't really tell you that it needs to be watered. You just need to check that soil. It's very important to take a look at the soil of a Ficus lyrata about every 5 days, just to check in to see what's happening. You can tell if it's dark colored, it's wet. You know, if it's light and kind of dusty looking on top, it's probably time to water it again. You don't want to let it go completely dry. You want to keep it a little bit more on the moist side. And of course, with all other plants, just avoid letting them sit in water. Very important.
Okay. And so it likes the more light and fertilization.
Yeah, they do like to be fed. The more you feed them, though, the faster they'll grow. So it just depends on the situation you've got. If you've got a spot where you like the size of it, I'd go really mild on the fertilizer. If you are hoping to get some growth out of it, then go ahead and feed it. High acid fertilizer is a great way to go. High acid fertilizer usually has higher nitrogen, so that higher first number. And because you're not really encouraging these to bloom, you don't ever need a bloom fertilizer for them, just a growth fertilizer.
Okay. Anything else with this particular plant?
Their big glossy green leaves tend to trap dust. And they are easier to clean than a small leaf ficus because you don't have to go, you know, each leaf you can wipe off with a baby wipe. That's what we use at the shop, is just regular old baby wipes. Versus trying to spray it down if it was a smaller leaf ficus. But keep it clean. Those big leaves are like big solar panels, and they are absorbing as much light as they can. So making sure they're clean will not only help them absorb more light, but it will also help them to help prevent them from getting pests or infections like spider mite or mealybug or any of those things. Just keep the leaves clean.
Well, and you bring up a good question here. I've noticed with some of my own house plants that, you know, they collect the dust. And I was told once not to wipe the dust off because it's just like scratching or scarring the leaf surface with little teeny pieces of soil. So I tend to put my plants in the bathtub and spray them off. Is that, you know, what's the correct way? What's the good method?
Well, spraying them off works really well. If it's just regular house dust, it's going to be fine. You're not going to damage the leaves. And as long as the, like a leaf, like a Ficus lyrata leaf, they're
it's
sturdy.
Thick enough, they're going to be fine.
Yeah, they'll okay. be fine. Or a philodendron leaf, one of those, they're not even going to notice you wiping the dust off. Some things like African violet leaves that are furry or staghorn ferns or anything that fuzz on the leaf, of course, you don't want to wipe that off. You don't want to wipe the fuzz off.
And with an African violet, you wouldn't want to put water on the leaves anyway.
Yeah, so you'd use an air duster or something to blow that stuff off. But for plants that you can stick in the sink and rinse them off, that's a great way to keep them. That's the only way to keep ivy. If you want to keep ivy alive in your house, you stick it in the sink at least once a month and rinse it off, or else you end up with spider mite. So it's just one of those things that you have to do. And so rinsing is really good. If you have really hard water, though, you'll end up with hard water spots all over your plant. So if you do rinse off, it's a good idea to do a final rinse with some distilled or filtered water to get any of that hard water off the leaves so you don't end up with white all over.
And that makes sense for me because I don't have a water softener. And Hyde Park has a lot of hard water.
Yeah.
Not as hard as some, but still it's hard water. That's what it is. So that's always good to make sure that once you're done, if you don't have any soft water, that you use distilled water.
Yeah, distilled water works just fine. It will help the minerals to wash off and not collect in little droplet shapes and dry on your leaves.
Okay. Well, you've been listening to Shane Taylor. He's the horticultural specialist and buyer for Cactus and Tropicals in Salt Lake City. If you want more information on this or other plants that we've highlighted here on Utah Public Radio, just go to the UPR website and click on Zesty Garden, and you'll find more information about these and other plants. Shane, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Brian.
This is the Zesty Garden. This is the Yes You Can segment. Adri Roberts is Cache County's Extension Family and Consumer Sciences agent. And we're going to talk about adding fiber to your diet. How easy is that to do? I'm thinking with fruits, don't drink the juice, eat the whole fruit. So like with an apple, you're going to get the fiber and the peel.
Right. Right. It just takes a little extra thinking, and I think you can add that fiber quite easily.
Or like a carrot.
Yes.
I love the carrots in my garden, especially digging them in midwinter. Mm-hmm. And we just scrub them. We don't end up peeling them at all. And I think it tastes better.
Right. Or your zucchini. Don't peel your zucchini. Go ahead and just grate them up and use them in your various recipes. I make a really great meatball. And I throw in grated raw carrots and grated zucchini and grated potatoes and just all kinds of vegetables. So it's really quite easy, if you think about it, to add more fiber to your diet. Start reading labels on loaves of bread and comparing the amount of fiber in those loaves of bread, and make sure that you're getting a higher fiber, coarse whole wheat bread.
So what difference does it make from one type of grain to another? Does it make much difference, or should you, you know, go for more oats versus whole grain wheat, for instance?
I just think you need a variety in your diet. So have them all. Have oats, have the whole wheat flour, have whatever it takes to make sure you're getting the flax seed is really good and really high in fiber. We are doing a lot of classes that kind of examines those different types of new to us fibers that will help you with your digestion and things like that. So, you know, give them a try, give them a taste, see what you think. And it's fairly easy to add more.
Now, I did want to ask a question about various types of wheat. Is red wheat, white wheat, Does it make much difference with debris products? I know my wife has tried spelt, mm-hmm. and she likes it because does it not have the gluten that's in it, or not as much gluten?
I think it's lower in gluten.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that can be helpful for for those that can't process the gluten as much.
Right. Well,
but nutritional value, is anything
nutritional
different?
Value, it's fine. Okay. Red wheat is a little bit stronger flavor. White wheat is not quite as strong. A lot of people use a combination, for example, when they make their own bread, they grind them up. And the thing that I love to do with wheat is to make wheat berries. And so I just take my whole wheat and boil it and let it sit for a few hours, and it pops open, and they're yummy. I add them to meatloaf and put them in all kinds of, you know, casseroles and things like that. But that would add a lot of fiber to your diet because it's basically the pure whole wheat. A lot of us have wheat sitting in our basements on our shelves that we never use. A lot of people are saving it for an emergency. And, you know, if you start eating wheat in an emergency, you're going to have some really bad problems with your stomach. So it's something you kind of need to work into your diet now. And where we're really into this fiber thing, we understand the importance of having a lot of fiber in our diet as a cancer preventative, then add the wheat berries now. Start boiling them up and using them.
So making the wheat berries, is it just, they just let them sit for a couple of hours?
You can either soak them first and then boil them up, or you can go ahead and just boil them and then they would have to sit for just a little bit longer. I usually let my wheat berries simmer on the stove for about an hour, use plenty of water. They will soak up a lot of water. So I let them simmer on the stove after they've come to a boil, probably for about an hour, and then I just leave the lid on, turn the heat off, and go away for 3 or 4 hours. When you come back and lift the lid, then they will be popped open. Some of them will still be closed, but they're soft and they're great. In fact, my husband will sit down and eat a bowl, pour some milk and sugar on them, eat them like oatmeal.
Wow.
Yeah.
So are they more nutritious once they've popped open? It seems like in the back of my mind, I'm thinking of something that's not available to the body to digest unless that wheat has popped open. And I may be thinking of the fermentation process. So if I need to, I can cut this part out. But
okay.
Does that sound familiar to you at all?
Not really. I don't know that I can answer that intelligently.
It was something in a book that I was reading that I interviewed the author. It's called The Drunken Botanist.
Oh,
and how
okay.
each different alcohol comes from a specific plant. And there was something to do with wheat, mm-hmm. that there's something that was available to the body after the fermentation process but wasn't before. So, okay. So I'll cut that part out.
All right.
So you would use wheat berries how? Like on a salad?
Yes. Put them on a salad. I throw them into soup. I throw them into spaghetti sauce. You can make a salad called tabbouleh that is fabulous. Recipes should be online. Just do a search for tabbouleh. Just very various methods. Probably my very favorite way to use the wheat berries, though, is in a meatloaf because it resembles ground beef. These little round berries.
Do you grind them up after the wheat berries? You just leave
mm-hmm.
them in whole?
I just leave them in whole. And then they also pick up the flavor of whatever you're using them in. So if you throw them into spaghetti sauce, they're going to pick up that Italian flavoring. If you throw them into the meatloaf, they're going to taste like the ground beef and whatever other seasonings you're using. It's a great meat extender. So if you don't want to pay $4 for a pound of hamburger, you can only, you know, cut down on the amount of hamburger you would buy and make up the difference in wheat berries. And, you know, this is one of those freaky things that if people really know about, they come unglued and don't want to try them. So keep it a secret again. They probably will never even notice them. And you're extending your beef, you're adding more nutrition, you're adding more fiber.
Can you can wheat berries?
No.
Do not can wheat berries.
Do not can wheat berries.
So would you just put them in a bag and leave them in the fridge?
What I do is I make a big batch of them, and then I do freeze them in small batches. So I have probably about a cup of wheat berries in a batch, and then they're kind of messy to make. You know, it's a big deal. And so I like to make a big bunch so they're done. And then I just put them into Ziploc bags and put them in the freezer, and as I need them, pull them out.
And how long will they last? if you just had kept them fresh? I mean, freezer, obviously, a while, but.
Oh, in the refrigerator, probably only about a week. But if you're frozen in months, probably 2 or 3 months, I try to use them up. And another great way to use wheat berries is to make fried rice. So pre-make your rice, say 24 hours before, put it in the fridge, because if you refrigerate your rice, it will separate, kind of dry out a little bit. It makes it perfect for ham fried rice. And then use a portion of wheat berries right in with the rice. And ooh, it's good.
Mm.
It's really good.
Well, you've been listening to Adrie Roberts. She's Cache County's Extension Family and Consumer Sciences Agent. And this is our Yes You Can segment. Thanks, Adrie.
Okay, you're welcome.
It's the Zesty Garden. I'm Brian Earle, and in studio with me today for Bug Bites is Diane Alston. She's USU's extension entomologist, and today we're going to talk about wings. Apparently, insects were the first animals to develop wings more than 400 million years ago.
Yes, a large group of international entomologists just completed a very large insect tree of life study, and they're really the first group to prove beyond a doubt, I guess is how you'd want to say it, that insects really were the first animals on our planet to have wings. So isn't that pretty exciting, I think?
So what were insects doing before then? Just crawling?
Yeah, so they didn't have they've traced back the lineage of when insects first started having wings to when plants, terrestrial, so land-based plants, were starting to grow in height. And so they feel that there's a strong correlation that insects needed to be able to fly high up to reach pollen, nectar, you know, other resources that were in these plants that were now growing much taller than they had before. And so wings were the solution, the evolutionary solution to that.
So any idea how that transition happened? It's not like, well, this generation no wings, the next generation has wings.
Right. No, it's a very gradual process. And so, yes, in the primitive insects, like even the primitive kinds of insects around today, if you think about things like silverfish, that's one of the common ones that people can relate to. And these other one group called bristletails, and there's these types that live in the soil called calimbula or springtails. Those are all primitive insects. And those insects actually, even as adults, do not have wings. There's no wings at all in their evolutionary history. And so we still have examples that are, you know, alive on the earth today of insects that don't have wings. They haven't developed the need in their lifestyle that is very, you know, land-based, very close to the earth-based. They haven't had the need to have wings and fly to move around. So it's a very gradual process. So the first insect wings looked very different from the way insect wings look today, and the way the flight muscles were developed and the structure of the wings and so forth. And so, and even within insects that have wings, so you may not be aware of this, but like flies, they actually only have two wings. So one pair, just the front pair of wings is developed. And in place of the hind wing, they have a little bump or knob called a halter that's used in balancing and, movement and manipulating themselves. But they only have two wings. And so certain groups of insects have, you know, changed in the way that they even use their wings today. And there's groups of insects such as moths that we know have wings, but then there's certain species that don't. There's some wingless moths. And so, you know, insects have evolved and lost the ability to have wings, you know, repeated times in different groups of insects over the millennia.
When you were talking about the number of wings, I was thinking of a dragonfly,
mm-hmm.
and the number of wings they have pretty clear. Mm-hmm. And so how does that help having clear wings versus opaque?
So I don't know specifically that clear wings give necessarily any advantage or disadvantage, but it may have to do with the type of material that the wing is constructed from. You think about like a dragonfly, they need a pretty strong kind of, you know, heavy wing to be able to beat as fast as they do, carry that large body of the dragonfly up to heights. They are predators that eat on the wing, and so they dive bomb their prey, catch them in flight, and grab them and eat them actually while they're flying. And so they have the need for, you know, large, strong wings. And so that type of clear membrane that they have is well suited for their type of lifestyle. Whereas an opaque wing like a moth, it's actually covered with little tiny fine scales, many, many of them all stuck together. And the scales really are, I'm sure they've evolved for many reasons, but some of the main reasons are they do give a color, or they can be used in camouflage. So a lot of moths tend to be dark in color. Camouflage, brown, gray, green, depending on what their background environment is. Whereas butterflies, who have scales, they tend to often have very bright colors, and that's to make them stand out so that, that during the daylight hours, their mates and so forth can find them. Scales also, of course, give strength and structure to the wing as well.
And you're, as I think of the difference between a dragonfly and a just a regular housefly, housefly just needs to go from one little pile of poop to the next one, where, like you said, the dragonfly is in the air. It's right. Got to be a little more acrobatic in the way that it flies. So.
Right, and they were some of the earlier insects to develop wings, you know, the ancestors of today's dragonflies, and they were very large. They were, you know, several feet.
Feet?
Yes, long. And so,
can you imagine those today?
And so they were flying up into these large, you know, what we would think of today as kind of tropical-looking trees, and obviously had lifestyles that were different than dragonflies today.
Any idea why we don't have those
giant
ones?
Insects today? Well, it takes, when you think about any kind of an organism, but insects are a cold-blooded animal. We've talked about this before on the show. They're very, very closely related to the temperature of their environment. So they have to have lots of heat. And so it's going to take a warm, hot, tropical environment to support a larger insect for that kind of level of metabolism. So that is why when you go to the tropics, you can find larger insects than you typically find in the more temperate regions. So if you go back in time when there were larger insects than are around today, it was heat was a lot of it. Also just lots of resources. So lots of, whether it was vegetation or whatever they ate, water, you know, resources available. That's a little different than it is today. We just don't have that same bounty and same extent that there was at that time period.
I'm just imagining them here, and it's like they could carry off a cat. That's or some other small animals. So I'm glad we don't have them. So looking at this study, how did they, were they just looking at insects in amber? How did they study the insects to determine?
No, they may have used some specimens, DNA that came from amber, but I think what I understood in looking at a few related stories was they actually focused in on, they said, 1,478 different protein-coding genes that were used in this big mega analysis that they did. And so they looked at insects from many different species. I think it was over 20 species, 9 orders of insects that they used in their analysis. And they combined all those to try to relate how closely related they were. And so they use a technique called optimization of a phylogenetic tree. So there actually was a little video connected with the article, I don't know if you looked at it, where they showed how, you know, like branches of a tree and like who, you know, you put, here's an ancestral insect and how is that related to another group. And then by doing this supercomputing optimization, you can see who's based on DNA most closely related to each other. And so it was a very large study. Over 100 international entomologists participated, and it was a big big effort, big tree of life. And we've been doing these kind of tree of life studies with other groups of organisms too, including plants, to look at how plants have evolved on this earth. And this is a kind of story that you might say, well, how does this relate to me? Why do I care about this? Well, it really helps us get a better understanding of how early life on the planet, and because plants, terrestrial plants, they started off as gymnosperms and then became angiosperms. So what we know today, all the flowering plants were so closely tied to insects. So the first big role for insects was, or one of the big first roles was as pollinators. And so they were the ones that were able to move the pollen between flowers and able for to help facilitate great increases in diversity of plants on that we have on the planet. Of course, they play many other roles too, you know, scavengers, detritivores, predators, and so forth. But really, it was the hand-in-hand kind of evolution of insects with some of these early plants that allowed the angiosperms to just thrive, and that's what we see on this earth today. And if it wasn't for insects, we wouldn't have that diversity, or our plant life might look very different. And the kind of human population we might have here might be very different as well.
Or non-existent.
or not here. Yeah.
Well, this is fascinating research. Thank you for bringing it in.
Yeah, certainly.
You've been listening to Bug Bites, part of the Zesty Garden.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the USU Partners in Business Information Technology Conference. Stay dynamic, stay ahead. Thursday, February 26th at the USU Eccles Conference Center. Details at partners.usu.edu.
80% of California's water goes to agriculture, which is 1% of the state's economy there. This week, as UPR continues coverage of water topics, Marketplace's Sarah Gardner looks at the Central Valley and the possibility of severe drought there. And throughout the week, tune into UPR for Our Water Source Facts, part of the 2015 Year of Water Programming Project here on Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden. This is our Living with Wildlife segment, and Terry Messmer is in studio. He's USU's Extension Wildlife Specialist, and today we're going to talk about groundhogs. Now, I've never thought of groundhogs really being in Utah, but apparently we have them.
Yes, we do. There are several species of groundhogs, and they're also called woodchucks. They're also called marmots, and so we've got a range of different species as you move across the United States. And so,
yellow-bellied marmots?
Yellow-bellied marmots, yes.
So
yes.
Have they expanded their range? Because I swear I never saw them in an urban area. Are these the ones that keep popping up by the side of the road?
There are. They're actually, in terms of range expansion, they probably all have been there, but you know, any wildlife population, depending on the conditions, depending on the availability, their population cycles, they tend to ebb and flow in terms of the numbers of animals. In the cases of this particular species, you might see it more active. You know, we're getting they're a hibernator, and so we're getting to the point where with this warm weather, they may break hibernation early, and you might start seeing them out looking for some of those green groceries.
And maybe also we're moving into their areas where they've always been.
It is. You know, these species typically inhabit the rural areas where they've got vegetation, pastures, stream banks, things along that line. And so as those populations increases, they will move out into other areas. But also as folks move into those areas, you can set up the stage for some increased conflicts.
Now, we have Punxsutawney Phil is probably the most famous of these, and we don't have one in Utah, but I found it interesting that Punxsutawney Phil only predicts the weather accurately 38% of the time.
Right. I guess they're not quite as good as Hogle Zoo in predicting the outcome of the Super Bowl, the animals there, but it's an interesting tradition, a long-lived tradition, and sometimes it works, and sometimes it may be seasonal. For example, the East Coast right now, where I guess Punxsutawney lives, I believe is in Pennsylvania, you know, they are actually experiencing winter. And so based on this year and his prediction, it looks like they're probably in store for a few more weeks, where out west the prediction doesn't apply.
So let's talk about their interaction here with humans. What are they getting into? What are their habits, and what should we be looking for? How do we control them a little bit better?
In typically most cases, if you look at woodchucks or groundhogs in rural settings, and if they're in their natural environment, which typically riparian areas, wooded areas where there's adequate vegetation along that line, they're right at home and they cause no problems. The problem occurs is when they leave those areas, when they disperse to other areas, when they get into urban environments where there are areas that typically are protected. In other words, there's no natural predator out there that can regulate populations. And so in those protected areas, they start multiplying and start moving out and start affecting gardens, start affecting fields, start affecting ornamentals, things along that line, which creates a problem.
And what are they getting into, or what do they eat?
They're herbivores. They're basically herbivores. They're large rodents, and so their diet, they have almost an insatiable diet for green vegetation. And so we have a lot of cases where gardeners, for example, we'll have them invading in, and they'll be picking the most succulent vegetation. We've got experimental plots at Utah State where they seem to be selecting for the most nutritious vegetation in those plots, and so they can cause an extensive problem, particularly if they focus on high-value produce.
So if you're in a very urban neighborhood, will you see them in the gardens that way, or is it more kind of like I've got fields behind my house? Before you go to another subdivision, would I see them there?
Okay, you may or not actually see them. You may see their sign. And again, most of these animals typically work under the cover of darkness where they do their best work, protected from typically natural predators or human interferences. So you may not actually see the animal, but you might see the sign in terms of the burrowing and also the sign in terms of the damage. And so, their den sites are fairly easy to find. They're well defined. They're areas that they've got fairly enlarged openings, and they may actually have multiple openings into that den site to actually provide them not only egress and ingress, but also an escape should something enter the den site. And so if you see them out during the day foraging and moving about, that probably also suggests your population level has got to a point where you might want to look at some type of measure to mitigate that damage.
So are they related to prairie dogs?
They're part of the rodent family, and prairie dogs are part of that, and the family Rodentia includes all our mice, and so that's the largest order of animals worldwide, mammals, and those are the order which typically, because of the number of different species and because of their herbivore nature, eating green vegetables, eating green plants, they probably create some of the most significant problems.
I'm guessing they don't have teeth like beavers that keep growing as much?
Actually, they do. They have, one of the things of the family Rodentia is they are Rodentia meaning gnawing animals. And so they have incisors that are continually growing. And so to keep those incisors in check, they have to constantly griddle, they have to nibble, they have to wear them down, if you will, to make sure that they're in check. And if they wouldn't do that, obviously you'd get a situation where the incisors could continually grow and expand beyond the capability of the animals to use them.
How do you know then you have, you might see them, but how do you know that they're bothering you? Because I'd just leave them alone if I'm not having them bother me. But what am I looking for?
Well, basically what you're looking for is the level of damage. And folks are pretty evident. A long times, in addition to seeing the damage, that you may catch glimpses of them actually out moving in the landscape during the daytime hours. And so obviously looking at the presence of the animal, the presence of the burrow system, and the type of damage, you can make that connection that's the animal that you're dealing with.
So are they going to be trying to girdle my fruit trees? Are they eating the bark?
No, they're really not. They're really not from the standpoint, if you look at, for example, voles or something along that line, which can cause extensive damage in girdling trees, or rabbits or something along that line, they're really not going to focus on those types of things. Their focus is typically on that green vegetation. And so what we're looking at are, again, situations where we've got garden produce, where we've got desired ornamentals that might be that they're going to be selecting for.
And what's the best way to discourage them from coming into your garden or into your farm?
Well, the long exclusion is actually to look at some kind of exclusionary devices. In other words, the old adage that good fences make good wildlife. If you have an area that they've been getting into, considering that they're also burying animals, what you'd have to do is put up a fence and make sure that the fence is buried long enough so deep enough that they can't actually excavate under. And so that's the ideal situation for areas where you've got maybe a small area. On larger areas, you might have to look at something in terms of population reduction, and that might include things such as live trapping. It might include things such as lethal control, shooting the animals, and removing from those sites. We really don't have any toxicants that are registered, any poisons, if you will, that you could use to bait those animals and eliminate the population that way. And so your options are fairly limited. And again, depending on where you're at, and, you know, obviously if you're in a city environment, you know, discharging a firearm is not permitted. And so things like you're looking at is using live trapping or some other mechanism, such as trapping, to take the animal and take them off the site and then euthanize them on site is probably one of your better options.
Once you trap these, where do you take them?
Well, obviously, when anytime you trap an animal, a live trap an animal, whether it be a groundhog, woodchuck, or any animal that's causing potential problem, you have to be concerned about what to do with that particular animal. A lot of folks like the idea they'll trap it, live trap it, and they'll move it on, and they'll release it somewhere off in the wild. Well, the animal that you release off in the wild, there's several things that can happen. Obviously, it can cause problems for other people, and the chance of them surviving in areas where that's typically not their habitat are fairly low. A lot of the translocation studies of animals that have been trapped and released using live traps, the survival rate's fairly low. And so in the case where you've got a situation where an animal is causing a particular problem, the correct method is to, if you can't handle it yourself or you don't want to deal with yourself, is contact maybe a local authority, a conservation officer, animal control, and they can assist you in the proper method of euthanizing that particular animal.
And woodchucks, if you've got a fence, they're not going to climb.
They typically will not climb, but they're tremendous burrowers, and they will go under it. And so if you're going to use that type of exclusion thing, you really need to look at burying some of that fence, you know,
another
18 inches to 2 feet below the ground, so that if they try to burrow under it, they're going to hit fencing, and that's going to be dissuaded.
Okay. We've been talking about groundhogs or woodchucks. Terry Mesmer is USU's Extension Wildlife Specialist, and this is our Living with Wildlife segment. And we'll have you back in again. Thanks, Terry.
Thank you.
This is the Going Native segment of the Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Barney Barnett, co-owner of Willard Bay Gardens in Willard. And we're talking today about Artemisia, and I have one of these. I love it, mostly because when I walk by it, I love to pick just a little bit of it and crush it in my fingers and smell it. So let's talk about Artemisia.
Okay, very good. Artemisia is the genus of the sagebrush. And when most people think about garden plants, they're not thinking that sagebrush is one that they might want to include. But there are some hybrids and cultivars of Artemisia that are very good garden plants. I have two on my list for today, if we could talk about them.
Sure.
One is called Powis Castle, P-O-W-I-S, Powis Castle. It's of hybrid origin. And the other is called Seafoam, S-E-A-F-O-A-M, Seafoam. And it is a cultivar of Artemisia versicolor. So it's a selection of a species that is not necessarily ornamental, but this particular one, Seafoam, is nice and ornamental.
And if I remember right, Seafoam was more lower growing than the Powis Castle.
Correct. The Seafoam is 12 or 15 inches tall and 15 or 18 inches wide. It has a gray foliage, and the foliage is quite stiff. It's some of the listeners might know silver mound, and this is like a stiff version of silver mound. I think a much better choice in the garden than silver mound. Sometimes silver mound can grow and get floppy mid-late summer, and the seafoam never does. It stays nice and tight and gray, and the foliage is fine textured and just a nice addition to the garden. We're not looking at a flower. We're looking at the foliage and the presence of the plant in the garden with its foliage and its habit.
How does it tolerate heat?
Good for heat. Good for cold. It's going to be either direction. Can handle colder temperatures. Zone 4-5, I believe, would be its cold zone, which is not as cold as like regular sagebrush out in the wild here, but still that's relatively hardy.
But you're talking about Cedar City, Logan is zoned.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So southern Idaho would be okay.
Yeah, yeah, it would do fine in all those places. I encountered the person who introduced it into the trade this summer. Her name is Lauren Springer Ogden, and she gardens in Fort Collins, Colorado, and I was in her garden this summer. And she mentioned to me that seafoam was one of her introductions, and I thought that was kind of fun that I got to you know, be in her presence. And I've loved this plant for a long time.
Now, can you grow it in warmer climates as well?
You could grow it in warmer climates. You could grow it, let's say, south of Cedar City, you know, as far as St. George, you should be fine.
And Moab's going to be okay then.
Yeah, Moab. Okay. Moab, because, Moab would be perfectly acceptable.
Now it's beautiful foliage. I've not seen, there aren't any flowers that come on it, but that I've seen in mine anyway, but the foliage is just this silvery sheeny.
Very silvery, and the texture of it, when you touch it, it's stiff. So you have this gray, stiff, interesting, fine textured foliage. It's a fun one.
Now, the one that I've got, it's I planted it because it died out. It just all of a sudden, I think it must have just been the winter. It's up against the house on the south side. So it's in this bed that doesn't always get a lot of water, but it seemed to do great during the summer. And then I'd had it in for about 10 years. Then all of a sudden, boom, it just didn't come back. What's going to kill Artemisia?
And that's the sea foam or a different Artemisia?
It was a different one, yeah. And the one I've got seems to be a little more light and airy, not quite as stiff. Is it the one you're talking about?
So you might have the silver mound, so you're going to want to try this seafoam. Too much water can be a concern. Wet feet, so to speak. Mm. And I guess on the other end, if we don't give them enough, there's occasion that we might lose them. But I think too much water would be more a concern than less.
So maybe it was just too much snow. Does it have an issue with?
Could be with that. That could have happened.
Well, I know I
but,
love
but
this.
But 10 years, ten years is a long time. Yeah.
What about wildlife? Did the deer like to eat it?
I'm guessing that's a yes.
Because it's in the sage family.
Yes, it being an Artemisia, and they're used to browsing sagebrush as they're out in nature, in their habitat.
And I would imagine it's adapted to a wide range of soils because I've got pretty heavy clay where it's at, and it seems to be just fine.
Yeah, you'll find Artemisias in various soils throughout the West. Let's not forget this other one I wanted to hit, and that's the Powys Castle.
And it grows taller?
The Powys Castle grows much taller, 2 feet tall, 4 feet wide. So it's quite a bit bigger, but it's not big in the sense that because it's 2 feet tall and 4 feet wide, it has more of a mounding feel, but a big mounding feel. Powys Castle, if you want a large gray form in your garden, it's perfect for that, for giving you a large gray form. The foliage is gray or silver gray.
And this is consistent color all through the growing season.
Consistent color all through the growing season. Often people ask questions about plants, i.e., well, what color does it bloom? And so they're looking for color from blooms. And this is color from foliage. So you have this color from foliage. The texture is soft, fine texture, soft on this big mounded plant that's just quite lovely.
What would you plant with it? Because I could imagine certain colors just really being set off by it. If you could get in something like an Indian paintbrush, because it might actually tap into the plant and use it as a
host along. For us, Powys Castle is herbaceous. So that means it comes each year from the crown. So it's going to emerge sometime April, May out of the ground. By June, it's going to be not fully sized, but fully out of the ground in gray. So anything that's blooming from June on, even into fall, will set that plant off. So whatever you're looking at from June on is going to do that. So you would choose plants that have the color palette that gray works with.
I could imagine some Agastache or something that we'll also talk in this program, Sauchneria. Just those colors against that silver would just be fantastic.
Yes, it's really great. The thing that you would want to do is, cultural-wise, is you're going to want to cut it down, and that can be done in the fall or it can be done in the spring to allow the new growth to come.
How far back should you cut it?
You could cut it back to 12 inches, even though it's going to get that other kind of size, up to 4 feet across in the summer. You could cut it back to 12 inches and it'll be fine. And this plant, probably in the St. George area, some of the warmer places that this signal goes to, it's going to be potentially shrubby and evergreen. So its nature is to be a small shrub or semi-evergreen anyway. But in our climb up farther north or colder, it'll act more herbaceous.
I was going to say, a regular sage usually keeps its leaves throughout the year. This is one that will drop them. And you'll see they kind of shrivel and then die back and then pop right out again in the
Correct.
Spring.
Yeah.
So, great. Well, we've been talking about Artemisia. Powys Castle is one, and then Seafoam was the other. And Barney Barnett is co-owner of Willard Bay Gardens in Willard. Thanks for coming in, Barney.
Hey, thank you so much, Brian.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. As an adult, I have made something of a study of topaz. Tom Lyon and Terry Tempest Williams, in their book Great and Peculiar Beauty, include a chapter written by some of the people who are in topaz, and I would like to read a little bit of this. It's by Yoshiko Uchida, Topaz, Winter's Despair. Toward the end of October, we begin to see snow on the mountains that ringed our desert, and even afternoons began to grow cold. A coal shortage soon developed, and hot water was limited to 2 hours between 7 and 9 p.m., bringing on a hectic scramble for the showers each evening. The sheetrock crews finally came to our block, but moved so slowly, they still had not reached our barrack when the first snows fell on Topaz. As though to compensate for this delay, small 10 by 20 inch mirrors were installed over each basin in the washroom, but by this time, I had grown so accustomed to washing my face without a mirror, I found it rather disturbing to look up and see my strange, sun-browned face looking back at me. The barracks that these people were in were pretty dismal. They were sheetrock barracks, temporary and not inviting at all. These people had been taken from their homes, often nice homes, and without their possessions, they were to bring only what they could carry. And they were brought to this desolate place. the story of these camps has become better known after President Ronald Reagan signed the Civil Liberties Act of 1988 and President George H.W. Bush issued a formal apology and token monetary compensation to all former internees. However, the events and causes of this tragic page in history must never be forgotten. If we can understand what occurred and why, we can ensure that a similar denial of civil rights will never happen in any future generations in America. So I'll continue with this woman's account. On October 30th, over a month after our arrival, the Sheetrock crew finally reached our room. "Hooray, it's about time. We've been waiting for you." We greeted each of them with much enthusiasm, only to learn that as the previous day, they had been given orders to install ceilings only. It was a bitter disappointment, but a ceiling was better than nothing, and we quickly carried our belongings next door while the Sheetrock crew worked on our room. The new ceiling made the room cozier, and sounds from neighboring rooms were now muffled, much to our mutual relief. A week later, with no explanation at all, another work crew appeared to install our sheetrock walls. We didn't ask any questions. We were now prepared for any kind of irrational behavior from those in charge of our lives, and we simply carried all our possessions once more to our neighbor's room while the new crew put up sheetrock walls. Now we had our stove and we had our walls. My father was anxious to put up some shelves so we could make our room more comfortable, and we looked forward to being able to settle down at last. My mother immediately ordered some heavy monk's cloth to make curtains separating our cots from the general living area near the stove. We needed this visual separation badly to give us a little privacy when one of us was ill or when someone came to talk co-op business with my father when the rest of us wanted to relax. Our friends continued to stop by Topaz as they had in Tenforan, and we gathered around the table near the stove where a kettle of hot water was always on hand for tea. Some young people who came to see my sister and me, while others were Isai friends of my parents. Sometimes gatherings were lighthearted. Sometimes they were somber and sad. Once an elderly Isai friend wept as he said to my father, "Uchida-san, I am old. I may die before the war ends. I don't want to die and be buried in a place like this." Well, this dismal passage urges me to continue with talking about Topaz. And so the next time that I have a chance to come to you on Petals and Prose, we'll continue this story. Please be aware of the importance of this issue. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.
Just go to UPR. The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.